Welcome to Commons Conversations, a series of interviews with campaigners sharing their experiences and insights into activism, learning in movements, radical history, and more. The podcast is produced by the Commons Social Change Library, a website containing over 1,000 resources for campaigners, which can be accessed for free at commonslibrary.org. This episode is from our second series and was originally broadcast on Community Radio 3CR. It features a conversation between Emily Wood Trounce and Alice Hardinge, the acting Tasmanian campaign manager for the Wilderness Society. In it, they explore the practice and value of citizen science and big tree hunting in locating and identifying threatened species. They discuss how this results in a number of valuable outcomes, including allowing conservationists to enforce existing rules regarding clear felling, while also supporting campaigns to fully end the logging of biodiverse ecosystems. The interview was conducted in late 2023 and begins with Alice discussing how she first became involved with forest defence.
I'm Alice. I grew up on Woiwurrung Wurundjeri country, Big Pat's Creek, which is close to Warburton. So that's in the upper Yarra ranges of so-called Victoria. And I've worked in quite a few grassroots organisations, as well as working for the Wilderness Society as a forest campaigner. And yeah, I guess I was so blessed to grow up in the stunning forests of the Central Highlands, Gondwanan rainforest. And back in about 2014 was my first kind of exposure to the Great Forest National Park campaign. And when I first became aware of some of the impacts that native forest logging was having on my local community. Yeah, I guess it really, my involvement really stepped up when I became involved in blockading. So through Forest Conservation Victoria and through Protect Warburton Ranges. I guess entering into the blockading world, throughout the Central Highlands, but also out in East Gippsland. And a really big campaign, I guess, took me to that next level of love for the forest and also involvement was in Big Pat's Creek when logging was encroaching within kilometres of my childhood home. Yeah, and that kind of brought me into the community space a lot more through Protect Warburton Ranges and also through Warburton Environment. And we saw many, many weeks of sustained direct action in that area, so close to my home, and that real passion and connection to the place, I think, was magnified through that experience of having grown up there, but then also seeing the machines and the extractivism just on my doorstep, and the joy of connecting with the community that I grew up in, really spurred this this passion and I guess that further involvement in the Victorian Forest Campaign and then, you know, onwards to the last year that I've lived in Lutruwita, Tasmania, and have worked on forest campaigns down here.
Brilliant. And how did you find Tasmania's forests and fall in love with them?
So I think my first penny drop moment down in Lutruwita, Tasmania, was a few years ago when I came down for the summer. So I came down for a couple of months and I remember the first week I was here. I had the privilege of going out with a group called Forestry Watch to do some citizen science out in the Styx region. And we went to an area of beautiful high conservation value forests that was still standing, but we also did a post-logging survey of an area that had been clear felled. And I think that moment of both the beauty and the intactness of these temperate rainforests in contrast with, it was a rather hot day, this quite bleak industrially, logged area and seeing some of those values and really recognizing the threat. That was a bit of a moment where my heart started, really pumping for, Lutruwita's forests as well. And over the following years, I came down over the summers and then, eventually moved here in December last year and, decided I really wanted to be more involved.
There's something so uniquely horrific about being inside a clearfelled coop. I think the first time that I experienced that, it shocked me and, changed my life entirely, the silence of the forest. And they're always, or pretty much always, surrounded by lush full forest with birds in them, and then you walk into the Clearfeld area, and it just is absolutely heartbreaking. I think that's something that we should all experience.
Yeah, I completely agree. One of most powerful kind of incendiary moments that I've ever experienced was also in a Clearfeld, and that was just before I got more involved in Big Pat's Creek and Warburton campaign. I'd come back from travelling after high school, and I was a couple of kilometres up the road from my folks' place, and there was, 120-hectare Clearfeld, five logging coops next to each other. Yeah, they just completed logging the top section, and they were logging further below down the hill. And just the starkness of that exposed area on the mountainside, and the lack of the animals, the lack of the trees. Yeah, it was really heartbreaking, but also really spurred something deep within me about fighting against that.
Yeah, you know, you and I have been on a few tours to Clearfeld together, and I've seen it be that incendiary moment for other people. Absolutely horrific. But before you mentioned your time with Forestry Watch and I guess this concept of citizen science, and I do want to talk to you about big tree hunting and what you've done with citizen science in forests across Victoria and Tasmania. Could you speak a little bit to that and the big tree hunting?
Like many folks, I think field work is probably my favourite work. Being out in the beautiful earth, really, and going out and looking for threatened species and for conservation values like the giant trees that you mentioned. I guess to go back to kind of beginning of my involvement in citizen science, at first it wasn't necessarily giant trees or large trees that we were predominantly looking for. I first became involved with wildlife of the Central Highlands, so in Victoria, back in 2019, then with Warburton Environment, looking for a critically endangered long-lived understory species, the Pisonia arborea. Yeah, at first, citizen science, it's super varied. There's many different things that you can go out and look for in intact areas of forest or previously logged areas of forest. But some of the things that we looked for were threatened species such as the leadbeater's possum, as well as the greater glider and yellow-belly glider, and then also flora species like the Pisonia arborea that I mentioned with Warburton Environment. And all of these species have certain prescriptions, so certain levels of protection. So by finding them, citizen scientists going out, volunteering their time with really amazing equipment, we can get buffer zones. So for instance, with the leadbeater's possum, every time you get a leadbeater's possum recording, you know, you note it down on your GPS, you get video footage, evidence, and you can submit that to the relevant government body and actually also potentially use it as court case evidence. And that way you get little patches of forest protected in the logging areas. So over time, for instance, Watch has protected over 1,500 hectares of forest throughout the Central Highlands. So that's wildlife of the Central Highlands, by finding these records of threatened species. There's some of the conservation values we look for, but also in Victoria with citizen science, I became involved in big tree hunting with Brett Nifsud as well. So going and looking out for very significant old growth trees, often eucalypts, and recording where they stand and where these kind of last stands of really highly ecologically intact areas with high ecological integrity are. So yeah, citizen science is super varied, and it's a super fun way to get involved in conservation by being out in the field, enjoying beautiful places, seeing unique animals that many people don't ever get to see because they may be nocturnal. Also, to boot, get areas protected from logging. So it's really a win-win-win in my situation. But, I've got to admit, one of my soft spots is the giant tree hunting or big tree hunting for sure.
And I want to return to the big tree hunting. But first, the leadbeater's possum, I know, is tiny. I think it's the smallest possum in the world, right? And they're critically endangered. There are so few of them left in the wild. They fit in the palm of the human hand. How on earth do you find a possum that small in the forest at night?
Yeah, that is a really good point, Emily. So the Leadbeater's possum, as you said, is this tiny and really, really critically endangered species. So there's only 1,500 of them left throughout the Central Highlands, and they've got quite a small endemic range as well. So in order to find them, you do need some specialized equipment. So what we use is we use infrared cameras in order to detect their heat signal in the forest. We also use some calling techniques as well to communicate with the possums, so to help call them in. Sometimes we also play powerful owl recordings, so they actually... they're really staunch little possums. As you mentioned, they're really small, but when they hear a powerful owl call, which is one of their main predators, they actually, in their family group, will sometimes come up and kind of like little possum ninjas investigate powerful owl calls to try and ward them off from their territory. So, yeah, we use those infrared cameras as well as video cameras, and we use GPS Garmin devices as well in order to, yeah, first detect these possums, but then also get really high quality video evidence, get also in the shot that image of where we are in location, just so we can really prove that these possums are out there in these exact locations, and then be able to get those buffers and protected areas in place for those species.
So pretty much you're telling me and citizen science teams were not out doing this amazing work in Victoria's forest, would they just be logging those regions? Like, would they just be completely smashed, these places with threatened species in them?
Yeah, well, that's something that is quite fascinating about, the real importance of citizen science in forest campaigning. Due to the state-owned logging agencies having jurisdiction, what I mean by that is they are, state logging is exempt from federal environmental law. So the states are regulating logging practices within their own states due to the regional forest agreements. So what we're seeing is the government not necessarily putting the required resources into surveying these areas and finding these threatened species. So then the gap is left to be filled by volunteer citizen scientists. And it's absolutely crucial that we have people going out into these forested areas, especially areas of forest that are under threat from industrial processes, be that through extractivism for logging or also extractivism for mining, like we see in Western Australia, and go out and actually record where these species are. Because, as you said, unfortunately, if it weren't for volunteer citizen scientists, many of these areas containing, in some cases, critically endangered species like the Leadbeater's possum would have just been logged due to inadequate surveying practices by the government programs.
That's so crazy that, you know, we have state-owned agencies logging, destroying and profiting from state-owned forests. They're just completely in control of the whole situation. But do you find that if you do get adequate evidence, you get a good video of a Leadbeater's possum, you GPS mark it properly, you put the report in all the right ways, does that guarantee protection for that forest? And for a leady, how much protection is guaranteed?
So it does actually guarantee protection through these special protection zones. These special protection zones are specific for each species, so, and also state specific. So some of the conservation values that we may find through citizen science in Tasmania will have different prescriptions, get different buffer zones to the species that we citizen science survey for in Victoria. So for example, the Leadbeater's possum gets a 200 metre buffer zone. So it's a 200 metre radius buffer zone around the location where it's recorded. So that's about 12 hectares of forest, which is better than nothing. But of course, it would be even better if we saw the cessation of extractive industries in threatened species habitat altogether. So this patchwork approach has done absolute wonders for the incremental protection of some of these species. However, systematically, of course, we still have a situation where poor regulation is allowing the extractive processes and the logging of some areas, which you know, never should be up for logging, considering the impacts on biodiversity and carbon and on these threatened species habitat. And of course, one of the limitations of citizen science is we have, you know, this great amount of enthusiasm and a lot of dedicated individuals. But when we look at the scale, for instance, in Lutruda, Tasmania, there's over 700 logging coupes on the three-year plan. So there's over 700 areas that are threatened by logging across the state. And even with the most dedicated and professional citizen science volunteer teams, it's, you know, it's a lot to have the capacity to do anywhere near the number of all those logging coupes. So we're really having to target areas that we've assessed as, you know, some of the most high conservation value areas, although really we would love to have capacity to survey the whole of the state. And the same goes with Victoria. Obviously, that's also affected by the end of native forest logging announcement that happened earlier this year in May.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild that this crucial work is left largely to groups of volunteers to go and spend their time in the forest. Surely this falls under the responsibility of the logging agencies. Like, you talked about the regional forest agreements. I know that they're not bound by federal environmental law, but they do have regulations, right? Surely it is their responsibility legally to do this survey work, to know what's in the forest, to not log where endangered species are. Am I correct?
Yeah, so there is a regulatory framework in each state. So, for instance, in Tasmania, you know, there's normally a timber code of practice, which varies in name state by state, but is the one of the codes of which the logging industry must abide by. There's also state legislation. So in Tasmania, we have the Forest Practices Act. In practice, it's again all about that resourcing, that prioritisation of doing thorough surveys. So there is a independent regulator in Tasmania called the Forest Practices Authority, who do issue the certification of individual logging area plans. So we call logging areas coupes a lot of the time. So these forest practices plans for specific logging coupes. However, there are questions around the co-regulation of forest practices, whether it is truly independent. And also, again, just on the ability to thoroughly resource and prioritise citizen science and surveying, government-issued surveying, because there really isn't, I haven't seen the evidence that there is really thorough surveying going on in Lutruda, Tasmania, and it was similar in Victoria. They're not dedicating the money or the people necessarily to actually go out and record all these high conservation values. And yeah, that brings us back again to citizen science and volunteers filling in the gaps, and also filling in the gaps on regulation. So we are recording a lot of alleged breaches of the Forest Practices Code, and also reporting to the Forest Practices Authority, the regulator, as well as the government, of whenever we find alleged breaches. However, there is also issues and questions around the effectiveness and the willingness to regulate as a state government and as a independent forest regulator. And a poignant example of this is we are yet to see any prosecutions from the Forest Practices Authority, the regulator down here in Tasmania, against the state-owned logging agency, Forestry Tasmania. So despite many alleged breaches being submitted by citizen scientists, so again, it's left up to citizens to make use of that space and try to hold the government to account for its current logging practices. I wouldn't go so far to say they need no regulating, but I would criticise the regulator for not taking more effective, consistent, regulation measures for the state-owned logging agency. So the regulator in Lutruda, Tasmania, also regulates private native forest logging, and we do see this skew between resourcing and regulating private land over resourcing and regulating public land. So I do think there are very reasonable questions to be asked around why the regulator is not adequately resourced to regulate, and why is there a lack of enthusiasm, seemingly, to regulate the state-owned logging agency for all the alleged breaches that citizen scientists report.
And why do you think there is that disparity between the regulation of private clearing and state logging?
It goes quite deep in Lutruwita, Tasmania. So we are seeing the end of native forest logging in Victoria and in WA, and we're seeing I would say quite an ideological shift in some of the populations of those states respectively around being aware of the effects of native forest logging, and also a bit of a cultural shift. However, in Tasmania, I do think we have a fair way to go when it comes to the ideological front. There is still a lot of romanticization around the logging industry. There's also a belief that it supports a lot more of the working population than it actually does. So studies have shown, recent studies showed that the Tasmanian population believed that 20% of people were employed by the logging industry, but it's actually less than 0.4%, a few thousand, including direct and indirect jobs. So I think there is a lot of ideological shift that needs to come in Tasmania, and that is also respective of the government's willingness to act. So at the moment we have a Liberal government in power in Tasmania. It's the last Liberal state left. But we also have a opposition, the Labor Party, who believes fervently in the native forest logging industry. And it's almost as if neither of them want to be wedged on the issue, so they're actually competing to be more pro-industry than the other. So I think that might be one of the reasons why we see poor regulation and poor resourcing of the regulation of the native forest logging industry.
Yeah, it's good to get that context, especially with the party that's in power and just sort of the cultural attitude towards forests and logging. But I think it's kind of surprising to hear that. I know that the forestry industry is sort of admired in a lot of places in Tasmania, but at the same time, like as a Victorian, I look at Tasmania and I think big trees, lots of conservation, huge national parks, massive amounts of that island are without roads, people go hiking, like there's this sort of, you know, people idolise nature in Tasmania, and it's interesting to think about that dichotomy of so much logging, so much industrial disruption of the forest, whilst also the romanticisation of these forest regions.
We are absolutely blessed down here with one of the highest ranked World Heritage areas in the entire world. And, you know, in different classes of reserve systems, some reserve tenures actually allow logging and mining, but you can say almost half of the state is in some form of reserve. However, as one of the most forested states in so-called Australia, there is also, that contrast with there still being 812,000 hectares in a land tenure known as permanent timber production zone. So that's the area that is subject to native forest logging of public land. So there is this, this large reserve estate. Some of those areas do still need further protection from extractivism. But then you've also got this huge area of land that has been set aside specifically for logging. So I do believe that Tasmania may end up being the Albany of whaling, but for native forest logging. So we are seeing shifts in New South Wales, potentially ending native forest logging or greatly reducing native forest logging there. And I do believe it is 100% possible for Tasmania, but I do think a lot of political, cultural, and I guess just community more broadly shift is necessary in order to get there. And part of that is also the deeply entrenched conflict over native forests that have revolved around Tasmanian politics for decades. You think of how foundational things like the Franklin blockade were, and how some of those effects are still felt, and some of those political influences from the 70s and 80s are still, you know, run rife here in Tasmania. And yeah, I feel like there is quite a bit of a way to go, but one of the advantages of having all those wild protected places throughout the World Heritage and different land tenures is that we know it's possible. There have been huge wins down here before for the environment. And I do really believe that native forest logging will end down here as well. We're just going to have to put a fair bit of work into getting the state ready to make that decision.
Yeah, and the longer it takes, the more forest, like irreplaceable forest, is going to be destroyed, and that's the stakes are so high. I feel like this leads quite well into talking about some of the work you've been doing with the big tree hunting and these sort of campaigns to like valorize the forests and these giant trees and rebrand Tasmania as this land of the giants, you know, helping Tasmanian people identify with these big trees, these amazing diverse forests as something to be really proud of and to admire a lot.
Yeah, so
what have you been doing with big tree hunting? Tell us about it.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, one of my absolute favourite things to do is go out into the stunning forests down here and look for these giant trees. So giant trees are another one of the conservation values that do actually get protection from logging when you find them. So just a bit of context. What is a giant tree? So definitional issues are rife within the conservation movement. But under Forestry Tasmania's policy, that's the state-owned logging agency's policy, a giant tree is a tree that's over 280 cubic metres in wood volume or over 85 metres tall. So first off, I need to say that for context, but I also want to say that that is completely arbitrary. If you're a swift parrot, you're not going to care if a tree is 84 metres tall or 85 metres tall. But it is important to note that when I'm talking about giant trees, I could specifically be referring to this policy that the loggers have. But going off into what does looking for giant trees look like and mean, it means lovely long days off track in areas of absolutely fantastic old growth, lots of cool temperate rainforests, and these huge emergent eucalypts. Often we're talking about Eucalyptus regnans, the mountain ash, or also Eucalyptus globulus, giant blue gums, Eucalyptus tasmaniensis, which is the Dalicatensis from the mainland. But these trees, in order to reach this kind of giant threshold, are often 17, 18, 19, 20 metres around the base when you measure them with a measuring tape. So we're talking about walking through these forests and coming across these ancient trees well over 500 years old for the eucalypt species to get this large. And they could be 6-7 meters in diameter, just this wall of wood before you. And of course, full of hollows and habitat for all sorts of threatened species. But one of the other really special things about these trees is if you find them on that permanent timber production zone that we spoke about, that area that is subject to logging, these trees also get a 100-meter radius no-logging zone. So they get an informal reserve created whenever we find these trees and submit them. So not only do you get to have that experience of walking through this wonderful old growth, but also by finding these trees, we're getting little pockets, 3.12 hectares per tree, taken off the logging schedule. So we, get out as much as we can and go out and look for these big trees, not just for conservation from logging, but also to measure how much carbon they're storing, as well as generally wanting to do some more scientific studies on these areas, because they are some of the most carbon dense forests in the world. And also, as far as tall trees and giant trees go, really the only place that you could compare it to of density of large trees and giant trees would be the redwoods. And the redwoods are world famous, and it's probably about time that we started valuing these giant trees. They're really just miracles of nature for what they are in Tasmania, instead of logging them for low value chip. So a lot of the giant tree work and the giant tree hunting is, yeah, really around finding these trees first off to stop them from being logged, but also about iconizing them and letting people know about them, letting folks know that, in Lutruwita, Tasmania, we have some of the largest trees in the world. They're really miraculous, and we should be visiting them and looking into regenerative tourism options instead of seeing that industrial clearfell mentality, because they're worth so much more standing.
500 years old is so long.
Yeah.
I've seen some big trees, nothing like what you would have seen, but yeah, every time you're with them, it just feels so amazing to think of how ancient this creature is, how much it's seen, how much life has come through it and moved around it and with it. But you're talking about finding big trees. Like, what do you mean by this? Don't we know where the big trees are? Like, are you actually discovering trees that the government hasn't marked out, that they don't know are there? Like, what is finding a big tree?
Well, it's exactly that. It's going out to areas that either have never been surveyed or are threatened by logging potentially. And yeah, the government and the logging industry, they don't know about where these trees are. So when we say big tree hunting, we are actually going often driving an hour, sometimes more, sometimes two or three, to a often quite remote area of forest, then spending the day, sometimes, 12 hours, sometimes less, walking off track through the bush country and into areas that are potentially scheduled for logging or that we know potentially do contain these giant trees. And we're walking through the forest, often using our GPS and after doing some desktop analysis, and we're finding these trees and photographing and recording them. And then we're letting the logging agency as well as the government regulator know about these trees, because without submitting that evidence, we wouldn't be able to get those protected buffers created. So it is something quite special knowing that these trees, as you said, like 500 years is so long, have been standing here hundreds and hundreds of years before colonization. And these trees are absolutely like of such value and also of cultural value. And I often think about how, if it weren't for, citizen scientists going out and letting the government know about these trees that, we still see quite often, without those submitted reports, these trees just get cut down. And, some of the listeners may have seen some of the single load log photos. So that's when a tree is so big that you can only just fit one log on the back of a log truck. And I think some folks may or may not have seen some of the photos of single load logs coming from Tasmania this year, and some got some international media attention. But yeah, we still see these practices of large giant trees getting cut down for cheap milling, cheap pulp and paper products.
Absolutely horrific. Those videos and photos of that, that one log that went viral, were heartbreaking and so, so shocking. Because, yeah, we all assume that this sort of thing has serious permanent protections, like that if a logger saw that tree, they would know, don't cut down this giant of the forest. But they're doing it, and then seriously turning it into, like pulping it, turning it into paper or cardboard is, it's a travesty.
It is. One of the things about going and finding these trees as well is, you have these really special moments, like looking just up at the grandeur and thinking how many generations of animals these trees have provided habitat and homes for. And you also think about, the amount of time that these trees have lived for as well, like seen all the changes over the last couple of centuries and how much carbon they've accumulated day by day, growing and sucking that carbon back into the soil and into the mycelium networks. It's really just, I don't really even have the words to explain how much I appreciate and love being out in those particular areas of forest that, have been without that extractivism for so long. They still have that ecological integrity and just amazing biodiversity as well. But I think these trees, there's still a long way to go in yeah, I guess showing the greater population, just how important and yeah, valuable, these places are, not necessarily only from an economic standpoint, although there are, again, regenerative tourism opportunities perhaps here, more so from an intrinsic value standpoint and from an ecosystem services standpoint as well. So I think, yeah, the more giant trees we can find, the better. Already just this year, we've protected over 30 hectares, from discovering these giant trees, of which the threshold is so high, it's quite hard to find trees that meet that threshold. These are the 0.01% trees or even less. You know, there's only a couple hundred that have been recorded across the state, and it's likely that there wouldn't be, there'll only be a couple more hundred, that haven't been recorded yet, before that threshold is reached. And of course, this is also in the context of, we've seen throughout the Central Highlands and also, in Victoria and also in literally Tasmania, the decline of large hollow bearing trees, especially at risk from fire and from climate change, which just makes it all the more crucial to find these areas and protect them whilst we still can.
It must be so interesting dancing with, as you campaign, dancing with these different systems of value. You know, you're talking about the intrinsic value of the forests, and this makes me think about the utter relief you must feel, you know, having grown up in an industrialized, extractive world, and then finding these giants, these pre-colonial trees, living in these sound ecosystems with so much diversity and so much magic inside of them, and just feeling that and seeing that, witnessing that, and knowing the intrinsic value of these forests. But then you're also talking about like ecosystem services, and you're definitely dancing the dance, you know, of our colony and the systems of value that are, you know, primarily financial within that. And yeah, we're also talking about carbon storage, these mountain ash trees being, you know, the most carbon dense species of tree in the world. And then we're talking about climate change and that whole, yeah, it must be so interesting, because I know from the way you're talking, I can tell that you're feeling the love for these trees and feeling their value outside of any of that, but then having to frame it in the language of Australia, the capital that we have here, and, you know, trying to translate in order to, as you're saying, iconize these trees and these forests for the greater Tasmanian Australian global population in a language that works for them. And sort of, you know, so much of environmental campaigning is shifting people along these systems of value so that they can get to understanding the intrinsic value of forests. But you often have to start speaking in much more, I don't know, empirical or practical terms.
Yeah, very much so. And I guess, you know, that one of the issues here is, the only way that we can get protection for some of these areas, some of these conservation values like giant trees or you know, Tasmanian wedge-tail eagles or devil dens, is by submitting the data, but ultimately playing by the rules that the government has provided through the Timber Practices Code, through the Forest Practices Act. And the rules are not great, to be frank. There's lots of grey areas. There are a lot of values that, you know, the prescriptions, the rules that we can apply, you know, they're very limited. And, there is definitely nowhere within the Forest Practices Act or within the Forest Practices Code or within, I guess, the, capital state regulation in general, that provides for intrinsic value. So as much as that, really speaks to me and speaks to many of us, unfortunately, when we're advocating for the protection of these places, often we will use what rules we have available to us, and that's a starting point.
And when you're doing all of this big tree hunting and iconising the forest, who are you working with? What have you been doing?
Yeah, so one of the great things about citizen science, big tree hunting, forest campaigning in general, is the community, is the people you get to meet. I mean, that's one of the things that really, really drives me, is those connections and that passion. So at the moment, I'm working in the role as acting campaign manager of Wilderness Society Tasmania. So within that role, I work with a great small team, but we also do a lot of work with local communities and, yeah, volunteer citizen scientists. So throughout this year, I've done a lot of work with quite a few different groups. The Tree Projects, absolutely amazing group, leading strong on science, canopy-led science. So you've got Dr. Jennifer Sanger, a forest ecologist, and her husband, Steve Pierce, who is an amazing photographer. And they're doing brilliant work on, yeah, really spreading the word about the absolute beauty and the incredible nature of some of the trees down here in Lutruwita, as well as Grassroots Action Network Tasmania. That's another amazing grassroots community group who have been out doing citizen science in the forests over this year. And there is also a Wilderness Society coordinated citizen science program. And we go out to the southern forests, out to the Styx, the Florentine. We've been up north around Quambi Bluff. And we do work with local community groups like Hands Off Quambi, as well as folks who live in Medina. So that's kind of a bit north, a couple hours north of Hobart. And one of the best things about citizen science is just that experience with other people, the friends you make, and the really strong connection with local communities who are super passionate about their patch. The area of forest that they live nearby to. But yeah, I mean, there's not much better than going out for the day, sitting under a big myrtle with all these magic coral fungi at your feet, having a picnic lunch with a couple of people who are equally as passionate about finding, yeah, conservation values, large trees, giant trees, devil dens, you name it, in order to get some protection for bush country.
Such special forest and such a special community, and yeah, really cool to hear about sort of the different nodes in the ecosystem of campaigners and citizen scientists who are doing this work in Tasmania. And I guess that brings us quite well to talk a little bit more about campaign strategy as we go forward. And I guess to give some context for the people listening, Alice and I are talking at the end of 2023, and logging industries across the continent are really shifting at the moment, because a few years ago, the Western Australian state government decided that they were going to pull the pin on native forest logging happening in Western Australia at the end of 2023. So in 2024, there will be no more native logging in WA. There are, of course, exceptions to that, and you touched on that briefly before, Alice, like bauxite mining in WA's Jarra Forest in the southwest of the state is entirely exempt from that declaration. So yes, there will still be some logging, some clearing in order to make way for bauxite mining, which is aluminium production. But largely, it is going to be the end of native forest logging in that state. And we're actually seeing a similar circumstance here where I am in Victoria, where just in May this year, the state government decided to end native forest logging at the same time, meaning that in 2024, the industry will shut down. And there are, of course, exemptions here too. We're still seeing salvage logging. We're still seeing pretty destructive timber clearing for fire breaks and this sort of thing. But that is, in both of these cases, an industry drying up. And we are seeing in New South Wales moves towards the same. And that's a totally new context, because timber production has been huge for all of these places and for Australia as a nation, except Tasmania. You know, and you're speaking to the industry there doing the opposite thing rather than moving to plantations and winding up this destruction of our native forests. It's ramping up, it's intensifying. And
yeah, it is such a fascinating time for forest campaigning right across so-called Australia. So, yeah, with the end of native forest logging in Victoria, it has actually had a direct impact on Lutruwita's forests, because we're seeing every day logging trucks driving across the state up towards Devonport, getting on the Spirit of Tasmania, and then getting off in Geelong and driving to the mills around Hayfield, high conservation value forests from Tasmania going straight to Victorian mills. So It is quite a delicate situation where in one area you've seen, you know, the cessation of an extractive industry, but it is actually having an effect on another region, on Tasmania's forests. It's really upping the pressure. And there is generally an acceptance amongst the industry. The transition towards plantation, you know, it's well and truly underway. In fact, if you look across the whole of Australia and then to Tasmania specifically, across Australia, it's about 90% of our wood products from plantation domestically. And in Tasmania, it's about 85%. So still quite high, a little bit lower than the mainland. However, what we are seeing is native forest logging last year in Tasmania was 7,000 hectares, and we've seen an increase of 1,000 hectares to the logging plans, a three-year plan. So now that means that next year 42,000 hectares are subject to imminent native forest logging. That doesn't mean that it'll all be done in the following 3 years, but I guess this speaks to the pressure of getting native forest products still to some of those mills in Victoria, as well as the ongoing native forest logging for Tasmanian suppliers. So from a campaign strategy standpoint, the pressure's really on for Lutz Schreuder's forests. And what we're going to see over the next few years is a real drop in supply of native forest logging products. So 2027, there's this huge drop off of supply, and that's due to overlogging as well. So it's really the crux of the campaign in many ways over the next year or two, about making sure that transition to plantation is completed, that we do see a cessation of native forest logging. And in order to get there, we're going to have to use many tools in our tool belt, be that people power, getting people out into the forests. There is also, I guess, scope for some more iconising of the forest areas in light of a once-in-a-generation election coming likely next year. So that's when seats will go from 25 seats to 35 seats in the Tasmanian Parliament. So we do have a lot of scope to see a government down in Tasmania with a lot more independence and Greens and possibly a balance of power situation. And there's also the need for some strategic litigation potentially from community groups as well as from ENGOs around the legality or alleged illegality of logging in this state. And something that I think is also really important from a campaign strategy standpoint is making sure that the supply chains, that the businesses who end up with the end products from some of this timber, again, most of it going to wood chip and disposable products, over 75% going to wood chip. But for those long-term products, those chairs, window claddings, things like that, there needs to be a really concerted effort to educate businesses about where they're getting their products from. And, well, yeah, that some of these items are coming directly from critically endangered species habitat, like the swift parrot. So I think there is a lot of work to be done over the next few years, some really big steps to make. But I do think completing the transition away from native forest logging to plantation is inevitable and also well and truly underway, despite the increased threat of logging in Tasmania of native forests due to the shutdown of the industry on the mainland.
Yeah, wow, you're really embodying that concept of diversity of tactics. Hey, you're talking about supply chain market-based campaigning, you're talking about citizen science, you're talking about the sort of corporate world, you're talking about, well, we have been talking about direct action, strategic litigation, taking them to the courts. There's so much work going into this. It's incredible.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of passionate people to get there. So, yeah, definitely huge recognition and shout out to the many, many diverse groups who are working on forest campaigns in Lutz Schreuder, Tasmania. There's so many amazing people, but we could always do with more.
Thank you so much for all of your work, Alice. And, yeah, so much respect, admiration and appreciation to everyone fighting for Tasmania's forests.
Yeah, thank you so much, Emily. And, yeah, just noting that all the work that we're doing down here in Lutruwita, Tasmania, is also taking place on unceded Palawa land. And, you know, when we're campaigning for these forests, first and foremost, they're twice stolen forests. They're stolen during colonisation, and logging is continuing without the consent of the Aboriginal people of Tasmania. So really wanting to highlight that as well.